Hello, the podcasted two. This is Bob Garfield, and before we start listening to our show, I wanted to offer my sincere special wishes for the holiday season.
Bob, don't do this.
What? Senior producer Kathy Rogers.
I mean, if you're going to ask for money, seriously, do not wrap it up in Christmas sentiment. It's beneath you.
You think so little of me, Kat. You believe I'd play the Christmas card to get donations?
Yes, Bob. Yes, I do. I know exactly what you're up to, and I just want it to stop. I mean, just ask. Seriously, just ask.
Silent night, holy night, all is calm.
Okay, I am commandeering this pitch. Listen, guys, when you give to On the Media by December 31st, you do three things at the same time. First of all, you support this podcast, and you enrich the community by strengthening public radio for all listeners, and you get a tax deduction. So don't forget, your gift today will help pay for another year of On the Media in 2014. Please visit onthemedia.org to make your tax-deductible gift now. Or text OTM to 25383 and a $10 donation will appear on your next phone bill.
Sleep in heavenly peace.
This is a re-airing of a show we first broadcast in the spring. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This hour of On the Media is devoted to ownership, specifically of intellectual property, mental products, as it were, though later we will take a detour into the physical. Last week, we saw the creation of the DRM chair.
Action!
DRM stands for Digital Rights Management, the safeguards copyright holders build into their digital products. DRM dictates whether you can move a song from one device to another or share it with your friends. This DRM chair I mentioned, developed by a team in Switzerland, only functions for 8 sittings. After each person sits on the chair, a knocking sound indicates how many uses are left. When the counter reaches 0, then the joints start to smoke and the chair collapses. The general message is that digital rights management, as practiced, is absurd.
Nowadays, much of the debate over intellectual property seems to have devolved into two extreme positions, either that intellectual property should be protected for all eternity, or that everything should be free. As Duke Law professor James Boyle explained a couple of years ago, neither is what the founding fathers intended. In the original 1790 Copyright Act, authors were given a term of 14 years in which no one else could encroach on their work. If they were still alive at the end of that period, they could renew it for an additional 14 years.
You give the limited right to the author to encourage production and distribution, and then you end the term and you have this world of free competition. Sadly, in the world of copyright at least, we've given up on that, and we have continued to lengthen the term to a point which is now utterly ridiculous. Copyright today lasts for your life plus 70 years. It's very hard to incentivize dead people to produce new things, but Congress apparently believes that it can.
Well, what you're saying is that if the idea here is to promote our intellectual lives and educate people, extending the copyrights of dead people is not likely to lend itself to that effort.
The tragic thing is that the people who wrote the Statute of Anne and the people who wrote the U.S. Constitution really thought the copyright's goal was about promoting access to knowledge. The idea of a limited term, of holding copyright short, that was central to that notion. That's how we disseminated the ideas. And of course, since lots of works are commercially unavailable, and we don't know who the copyright holders are, we can't find them, they're so-called orphan works. In many cases, copyright acts as a fence, which means you can't distribute works. Even if you wanted to pay, you can't pay. There's no one you can pay to make a new edition, to make a movie out of it. In this case, it's a one-way valve. Copyright takes the stuff in, almost like a black hole, locks it up, and now you can't get it out. This is exactly the opposite of the idea behind the U.S. Constitution, which is, let's promote the flourishing of human creativity.
Jamie, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
James Boyle teaches law at Duke University.
Well, there are good guys and there are bad guys.
a song from Camper van Beethoven, one of David Lowery's bands. Lowery, an early champion of the freedom of the internet and a teacher of music business, says the current environment is crushing musicians, but not because of overregulation. He says the culprit is the government's lax response to pirate sites, which leaves artists at the mercy of places like iTunes or Google, which throw pennies to creators who otherwise stand to earn nothing. Moreover, he says the prevailing notion among the digerati that music consumers shouldn't have to pay makes the situation worse. In Lowery's blog, he argues in favor of the infamous old record company system. The new boss, he wrote, is worse than the old boss.
I did this as hyperbole, right? We could agree that basically artists do not receive very much revenue under the old record label system. But most people ignore the fact that the labels actually gave artists advances based on moderate success. And yet, they also expected, like, say, 9 out of 10 of these artists to remain unrecouped and never see any royalties other than their advances. And when you compare that on average to what somebody directly doing a deal with iTunes gets, they actually get less. Now, one place where revenue does rise that's really interesting is the artist response to falling recorded music revenue is to tour more. Most artists are playing for less people, essentially with the same expenses.
So why do we keep hearing that artists are doing better?
One of the reasons is because there's reports floating around on the internet. There's one called The Sky is Rising. Now, everybody looks at that and goes, well, yeah, look, it says revenue's up. These are studies that were paid for instance, the internet lobby. But look at the fine print. What they're including as revenue, for instance, is iPod sales. They have musical instrument sales, right? There's charts in there that show digital revenue rising. Well, of course it's rising. It started at zero. There's another chart in that very report that says the number of music transactions is rising astronomically. Well, before iTunes, only a handful of songs were available as singles. So now, essentially, instead of buying one album, you're buying 14 tracks. And a host of other things. And that's not the only study like that. There's a bunch of them out there. They're all commissioned by companies that would like the status quo to continue as it is.
Well, what about the argument we hear that maybe artists are making less money, but recording costs are lower, so they're doing okay?
Not true. I have run a studio complex for 20 years. Yes, the recording device itself has gotten cheaper. But the highly skilled labor is charging as much as it did in the past. We have recording costs falling, but not nearly as much as people think they have.
Well, what about the argument that artists now get to communicate directly with their fans, and these core fans can support them?
Yes, I think certain kinds of artists, you know, like Amanda Palmer, is very gregarious and willing literally to show her breasts to raise money.
I think okay? That may be a slight extreme example, but okay.
Okay, well, I'm just saying that there is a certain gregariousness. Could you imagine like a Jimi Hendrix raising money this way? How do you raise money from non-existent fans when you're making something that people don't know that they want?
But hasn't that always been the problem?
Well, yes, but we had a logical way of compensating those who took the risk, right? Founder of Atlantic Records, Ahmet Erdogan, didn't have to have a crowd of people first agree to take a chance on, say, a Led Zeppelin record or a Captain Beefheart record. These were things that the people didn't know that they wanted yet. But because he knew he would be compensated in a rational way, if he were right, he would take the risk.
Would you say the cure is simply getting the services where people get their music now, Spotify, Pandora, iTunes, Google, to pay the artists more per listen?
Look, a lot of people don't like me picking on iTunes because iTunes represents something bigger in people's minds. It's like addressing Santa Claus and his union troubles with his elves or something. But listen, iTunes takes 30% of gross revenue. The old mom and pop stores with their physical goods, breakage, shipping, stoned employees, electricity costs actually took 40%. So how do you go from total brick-and-mortar, physical, inefficient system and only save 10%? Ultimately, in the background, all artist negotiations, there's this notion that, like, this is going to keep happening and you're going to get nothing, or you could sign this agreement with us and you'll get a little tiny bit.
Do you think this situation will be fixed?
I think that actually it's much easier to fix than people think it is. Largely, the infringement goes on the internet, right? The companies that do the infringing make money through premium fees that they charge through MasterCard, Visa, Amex, PayPal, or they do it with advertising. So stop companies like MasterCard and Amex and PayPal that allow these sites to have accounts with them. They're not supposed to be doing it anyway by law right now.
Part of what really irks you is what you see as hypocrisy on the part of some of your erstwhile friends in the Digerati, people like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which are staunch defenders of internet privacy, but also seem to be equating the use of other people's property with freedom.
Well, here's what the Electronic Frontier Foundation refuses to acknowledge, okay? Freedom is actually a careful balancing act between the rights of different parties. Freedom is actually not this thing that the Electronic Frontier Foundation sells you. They're selling you nihilism, where basically everybody gets to do whatever they want to do, no matter what it is. To me, the bigger problem isn't even piracy. The bigger problem is this notion that floats around in academia, and especially in progressive circles, that somehow it's going to be good for us if we kill the record labels and the movie studios. That's actually the big danger. If we don't have a market-based cultural goods system, we're left with patronage and government subsidy. The right wing in this country is never going to go for tax dollars going to artists. And besides, do you really want the government deciding which artists get money? On the other side is patronage. Who can afford then to be the patrons of art? This is the craziest thing that I think the left in this country is going through in academia. I think they're like drinking the great Kool-Aid right now.
David, thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
David Lowery is a member of the bands Camper Van Beethoven and Cracker and blogs at Tricordist.
Coming up, is fan fiction simple copyright infringement or a heartfelt love letter to the source material?
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Happy Birthday, possibly the most well-known song in the English language, is privately owned. If you want to use Happy Birthday in your film or your TV show or even sing it in your restaurant, you'll pay. That's why Chili's serenades its patrons this way. On the Media producer PJ Vogt offers this deep dive into the long and instructive history of Happy Birthday. Of course, he notes, it's not just restaurants that go to great lengths to steer clear of this long-protected ditty.
TV shows and movies do this too. To avoid the fee, they'll ask us to believe that their characters live in an alternate reality, where birthdays are noted like this.
Happy birthday, happy birthday, happy birthday, happy birthday.
Or this.
Happy, 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 happy. I'm so happy today.
Or this from Mr. Rogers, which is actually very sweet.
We thought we'd try to tell you how we love you on your birthday. We thought we'd try to sing and dance and play today.
How much you actually pay to use Happy Birthday depends on how much money you've got. Talk show host Wendy Williams complained about having to pay $700 to broadcast it on her air.
We had extra money in the budget this week, so we paid $700 to sing Happy Birthday, because you know you got to pay for
serious?
The song. So come on, audience, let's not waste this money. Happy 60th birthday to Natalie, and 3, 2, 1, hit it.
Happy birthday.
But Wendy Williams actually got it pretty cheap. The fees can reportedly go as high as $10,000 for 6 notes and 5 words. There's an episode of the old Aaron Sorkin show, Sports Night, that's just devoted to the insanity of this. A TV anchor gets in trouble after singing Happy Birthday on air.
I think it's sweet that you and your partner sing to each other on television. Others may think it's vaguely gay, but I disagree. Nonetheless, you can't do it anymore.
Why not?
It's against the law.
It's against the law to be vaguely gay?
It's against the law to sing Happy Birthday on television.
It's against the law to sing Happy Birthday on television. Happy Birthday is protected material.
Yes.
Who holds the copyright to Happy Birthday?
The representatives of Mildred and Patty Hill.
Mildred and Patty Hill?
The authors.
The authors.
They wrote it.
They wrote the song.
Did you think that song just happened?
They were sisters, of course.
That's George Washington University law professor Bob Brownice. He says that the Hill sisters were way ahead of their time. They were born in the 1860s in Louisville, Kentucky, where their father told them that it was better to live in a hollow tree than depend on a man for a home. Neither ever married.
They were way too hot to handle for men of those times. Mildred, the composer, went and sat in the back of black churches and transcribed spirituals because she said they were going to be the backbone of American music of the future. And if you can imagine in the South in the 1890s taking that attitude, that's just amazing.
We know Mildred believed this because she wrote it down. She wrote an article called Negro Music under the pseudonym Johann Tonsor, a person she seems to have completely made up. The composer Dvorak read her article, which we know because it's in his papers with scribbles from his kid on it. A few days after reading it, Dvorak started the musical sketches for what became his masterpiece, New World Symphony. Considered revolutionary? For the inspiration it drew from African-American spirituals. When she wasn't writing as the fictional Johann Tonsor, Mildred wrote her own songs. One of them, written with her sister Patty, was called Good Morning to All. At the time, the sisters were writing deceptively simple songs in a very methodical way.
They wanted to write a whole book of songs for kindergarten, songs that would be simple and yet would have, you know, would be catchy, would be dramatic.
Since the sisters were teachers, they used their students as their focus group.
They would come home in the evening, they'd write some songs, and then they'd go back into kindergarten the next morning and see how well the kids could sing them, could remember them. And when it turned out that there was some note that wasn't singing very well or wasn't sticking in the kids' memory, they'd go back and change it in the evenings.
From that, they got this.
It was designed as a greeting that children would sing to their teacher when they arrived in the morning. It was actually surprisingly well known by the 1920s as a kindergarten song.
At some point, and this is one of those tiny historical footnotes that later becomes very, very important, somebody added the famous Happy Birthday lyrics to the Good Morning to All melody. And that song took off. But why?
You know, implicit in part of your question is, why wasn't there a birthday song already before then? It only emerged in the mid to late 1800s that you started having some dramatic moment at a celebration of somebody's birthday where it would be appropriate to burst into song. Once those parties started happening, people were looking around, I think, for a tune that everybody knew. And what was the tune that everybody knew?
Here it is in the 1930s in the film Stella Dallas. It's just a few notes to start a scene, to let the audience know, hey, we're at a birthday. It was already cultural shorthand, a song that belonged to all of us, except that it didn't. From the beginning, the Hill sisters wanted to own their work.
They were careful to tell the kindergarten teachers in Louisville, you can sing it in your classrooms all you want, but please don't write it down and distribute it. I think that they were working with a publisher, and that shows an amazing awareness of what it might take to forfeit a copyright.
In 1934, a third younger Hill sister, Jessica, sued Irving Berlin. He'd used Happy Birthday in his Broadway musical as thousands cheered. That lawsuit prompted Jessica to finally register copyright for the song in 1935. And from that point on, the Hills were entitled to payment whenever the song was used.
Were they wealthy from this in their lifetime, the sisters?
Not really. No. The song, you know, generated in the thousands, which I guess back in the 1930s and 40s is more money than it is today. But the millions did not come until the 80s and the 90s, and they were long dead by then.
They weren't on, like, cruises eating shrimp cocktail.
Right, and smiling every time the cruise had a birthday. Yeah, they were not doing that.
Eventually, the company that had published the song for the Hill Sisters was bought by another company, which was bought by another company, and so on, until ultimately it ended up the property of Warner Chappell, the publishing arm of Warner Music Group. Warner Chappell earns about $2 million annually from Happy Birthday to You. But Brown Ice is actually pretty sure that Warner Chappell's wrong to think that it owns the song. First, because the copyright to the melody actually expired in 1949.
The tune was originally published in the 1890s. Copyright in that is long gone. So you can play the tune all you want. The problem with just playing the tune is that if you want a birthday scene in your movie or television show which looks realistic and sounds realistic, people aren't actually just humming in that scene. They're singing the words.
But Brown Ice doesn't think that the Hill Sisters actually wrote the words.
There's amazingly little evidence that it was them. You know, I don't think we'll ever know. But it's still the current owners of copyright who have the burden of showing who wrote those lyrics. And at this point, over 100 years after that composition happened, they're not going to meet that burden of proof.
The truth is, it kind of doesn't matter. Copyright law isn't an ironclad dictate like the border of a country. It's a lot more like land claims in the Wild West. You own what you can defend. Warner Music Group is a behemoth. No one's ever seriously challenged it over Happy Birthday, and no one's likely to. The money it collects comes from a lot of disparate places. A Sony movie here, a TV show there. Those places are not likely to sue Warner. And so we're stuck. At the very earliest, Happy Birthday will enter the public domain in 2030. That's 137 years after Mildred Hill composed its six-note melody.
These sisters were working back at a time when there was no recording industry. There were no talkies. There were no motion pictures with synchronized sound. And the song started out way back then, and it has had a copyright history that covers the entire development of the recording industry and the rise and fall of vinyl records and CDs and cassette tapes, and now we're into digital streaming, and the song still has a copyright profile, and that's an amazing thing.
Think about that. All the Hill Sisters cared about were sheet music pirates. And it's not just our culture industry that's changed dramatically. Our idea of what copyright means has too. The Hill Sisters expected that their sheet music would be protected for 28 years, plus an extra 28 if they wanted to renew it.
Copyright was something that you did, right? It was a verb, and that verb goes back to an era when you actually had to take some affirmative steps. In their era, in the 1890s, you had to register a song. You had to file the title of the song with the government before you published it. And you had to place the year that the song was published on the published copies so that people could calculate whether the song was still protected or not.
Today, anything you do is automatically copyrighted, and it stays in place until 70 years after you die, whether you intend it to or not. And because Happy Birthday's copyright claim has extended through this evolution of an ever broader definition of what it means to own an idea, we've landed here, with a song that most of us feel like belongs to all of us, but doesn't. But if Brown Ice is right, that the copyright isn't actually valid, there might be a way to change that. If I record myself singing Happy Birthday, which no one would ever pay for anyway, put it in the iTunes store, then I could have a lawsuit, and that lawsuit could prove that they do not have the rights to Happy Birthday.
You could bring a lawsuit, or they could sue you, but remember that they always have the option of saying to the court, we will not pursue this, you know, badly sung version on iTunes, which only four copies have been sold of so far. And the court's going to say, why are you wasting my time? They've just told me that they're not actually threatening you.
Unfortunately, we won't know whether or not Warner Chappell would sue me, because WNYC's lawyers have emphatically nixed that plan. But I feel deep in my heart that the ghosts of Mildred and Patty would be fine with it. For On the Media, I'm PJ Vogt.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Mildred. Happy birthday to you.
On Thursday, the New York Times reported that a member of the Baker Street Irregulars, a group of Sherlock Holmes aficionados, filed a complaint against the Conan Doyle estate, arguing that Holmes and his world were in the public domain. And the Times quotes one lawyer, Darlene Seipzer, charging that the estate, quote, is going around bullying people. She had self-published a trilogy about the young Holmes. She's a writer of fan fiction, a genre that's been supercharged by the internet, now awash in fan-created derivatives of everything from Harry Potter to the Gilmore Girls, sometimes with audiences exceeding a million. Rebecca Tushnet also writes fan fiction, teaches law at Georgetown University, and heads the legal committee at the Organization for Transformative Works, a nonprofit designed to protect writers like her, who she says are no longer shunned.
One thing that has really changed over the past few years is that copyright owners have really started to understand that fans are fans. They are a good thing to have, and one thing that fans do is they create more stuff.
If I am a fan of, you know, let's say Harry Potter, and I do some sort of fan fiction, I'm free to go crazy with my versions of the characters and the developments. What happens when I try to sell those for a buck on my website?
There are such things as commercial fair uses. When the Daily Show runs clips from the news and comments on them, that's fair use. And it's possible to have fictional fair uses as well. However, the bar is higher, and it really would be a case-by-case determination. For example, there was a preacher who wrote a version of Harry Potter in which Harry Potter came to Jesus and renounced magic because it was evil. Whether or not that's good, it clearly does have a critical message that comments on the original and is something that would never be part of the original. And that makes it have a good case for fair use, even if he then solicits donations or even sells it for a buck.
If I'm getting this right, you can write the anti-Harry Potter and go commercial with it. You cannot write the evolution of Harry Potter and do the same thing.
The more you are just continuing the story, the less likely a commercial version of that would be fair use. But for example, there was a case some years back where a woman named Alice Randall wrote a book about Gone with the Wind, retelling the story with a half-sister of Scarlett O'Hara, who is the daughter of a slave. And it basically told the story from an African-American perspective, revealing some of the hypocrisy and white supremacy encoded in the original. And a court found that that was likely to be fair use because of the way it commented on the original.
One of the great literary events of 2012 was Fifty Shades of Grey, which is sort of kinkerotica that has its roots in...
It was originally a piece of Twilight fan fiction that has the basic Twilight structure but doesn't actually copy any of the expression.
Some authors have been welcoming to fan fiction. Stephanie Meyer, the author of the Twilight series, being right at the top of the list. Others are kind of reactionary. The novelist Anne Rice has a very different view of her vampire fiction. Why do you think she's taken such a hard line?
There is a completely understandable feeling that other people get it wrong or that you're very protective of your characters. The fact of the matter, though, is once they're on the page, those characters start to live in other people's hearts, too. And the only question is whether you'll find out about it, not whether it will happen.
We're talking about this as if it were some sort of novel phenomenon. In fact, the idea of derivative works goes back probably to all literature ever created by man.
Certainly, the Odyssey is a collection of stories that were told and retold, and each time the storyteller added his own particular spin on them. It goes on in every form of art, in painting, in poetry, in music. It is actually the way that humans make stuff.
So then, where does the natural order of things that you've just described conflict with the legal and commercial infrastructures that keep the system, you know, running smoothly?
So I think the good news is that it doesn't have to conflict with the core copyright structure, which is valuable. You know, The Avengers is a movie that I like having in existence, and it's the kind that requires a big structure able to fund big productions. And that does require aggregating a bunch of little payments from movie tickets and DVDs and so on. However, the commercial sector can never fully take over the realm of human production. And once we respect that, then we can live in pretty good harmony, I think.
All right, one final thing. You mentioned at the very outset that you came at this as a fan. I'm just curious what a legal scholar is such a fan of that she writes privately for her own amusement.
Well, gosh, I started as a kid with Star Trek. In law school, it was The X-Files, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Smallville, now the show on the CW called Supernatural. I am, I would say at this point, a fan of fandom in all its weirdness and all its wonderfulness.
Rebecca, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Rebecca Tushnet is a law professor at Georgetown University and head of the legal committee for the Organization for Transformative Works.
Coming up, why plagiarism is the new poetry. And the next big intellectual property debate will be over actual property, atoms, not digital bits.
One of the things about physical goods that is a huge difference from music and movies and articles and photos, not all physical goods are necessarily even protected by copyright.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It goes without saying that the digital revolution gave us life-changing innovations the world had not seen since the Industrial Revolution. Now imagine yet another transformational development merging the digital and industrial revolutions. I refer, of course, to 3D printing.
You know, like Star Trek's food replicator.
Tomato soup.
There are 14 varieties of tomato soup available from this replicator, with rice, with vegetables, bouillon style, with pasta, with...
Plain.
Specify hot or chilled.
Hot. Hot, plain tomato soup.
And of course, the galaxy's most famously replicated smoke and beverage.
Tea Earl Grey, hot.
Yeah, but right now, here on Earth... For instance, at this moment, early adopters already can make a wrench using a blueprint downloaded for free from the internet. Instead of clicking print, they click make. So, what happens when everyone can be a manufacturer? Chris Anderson, former editor of Wired magazine, is the author of Makers, The New Industrial Revolution. He described what someday soon we'll all be able to do from our desktop.
You know, the inkjet you've already got on your desk takes pixels on the screen and then spits it out into little blobs of ink on paper. Imagine if it just kept doing it layer after layer, and rather than ink, it was using something else, like little bits of plastic or metal or glass and things like that, and that it built up a 3D object, and that you could just take an image on the screen, then press make, and 20 minutes later, you would actually have the thing you could hold.
Okay, so we can print out a wrench. Please explain to me why that is revolutionary.
Well, right where desktop publishing was in 1985, there was software that would allow you to do things that used to require a typographer's union. Kind of extraordinary because it added the word desktop in front of a word that was previously industrial. It didn't change the world by itself, but what it did do is it kind of liberated the concept of publishing from industry and put it in the hands of regular people. And then along came the web, and published went from generating paper on your desktop into a button in your browser, and with a single press, you could reach 8 billion people, theoretically. The 3D printer is the first step. It has liberated the idea that, yes, you can make something. You don't need to be a machinist. You don't need permission. You can press a button, and something will come out. And it's going to take 20 minutes, and it's going to be plastic. But to be able to go to the next stage, the web stage where you've got a button in the browser that says manufacture rather than publish, that's going to happen sooner than it did.
For those of us like me who have a history of inability to have a vision of the future, give me an idea of the ramifications of the ability to press manufacture.
When professional tools get in the hands of amateurs, they change the world. It is the explosion of participation and creativity and innovation that happens when you don't need permission to use things, when it's not hard, when people who are not necessarily trained in this, but just sort of do it for their own reasons. That really is what the web is. The web is just a new way of working together online with people who otherwise wouldn't have been allowed to in the old model because they didn't have access to the tools. Manufacturing is the biggest industry in the world. We've seen what the web can do to media. If we've seen what the web can do to communications, just imagine what the web can do to the biggest industry in the world. And the moment when we're empowered to do that experiment, to actually play that out, has finally arrived.
I guess I have to know if whether mere mortals can be trusted with the democratization of the physical world. Will they steal intellectual property from others? Will they make guns and nuclear triggers? I don't think you have to be entirely paranoid to see a lot of negative potential consequences.
When personal computer came out, you know, people first asked what they could do with it, and then they quickly had answers. And some of those answers were, you know, video games, and some of them were spreadsheet, and some of them were computer viruses. When the genie gets out of the bottle, you get a really widespread of uses. You can't print a gun. You can print parts of a gun. I think that it's a really bad way to make a gun. If you want, first of all, this is America. You can buy guns at Walmart. It does raise challenges for intellectual property. Clear as copyright law is, it struggled to adapt to the digital age. And copyright largely affects the creative arts, words, pictures, video, music, etc. What about physical stuff? How does copyright law apply? You know, what element of this coffee cup is creative and what part is covered by other intellectual property law like patents or trademark or not covered at all? And how many polygons is piracy?
I think you could make a pretty good argument that the digital revolution changed humanity. Do you predict the same for 3D printing and other digital manufacturing technologies?
I do. If the past is prologue, and in fact, there are more people out there with good ideas for making stuff than there are currently making stuff, they won't just be better products, cheaper, but also new products, new categories we'd never thought of.
Chris, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob. It's good talking to you.
Chris Anderson is the CEO of 3D Robotics and author of Makers, The New Industrial Revolution. So if 3D printing does revolutionize the way we think about production, maybe about ownership itself, it also will disrupt existing business models. And if history is any guide, those disrupted businesses will push for laws to keep our fingers off those buttons. Michael Weinberg is a vice president at Public Knowledge, a nonprofit dedicated to preserving the openness of the internet. Michael, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you so much for having me.
You wrote a piece called, "It Will Be Awesome If They Don't Screw It Up." Who's they, what's it, and how are they going to screw it up?
There are potentially many theys. I think the most important theys are probably members of Congress. It is the potential of 3D printing to do some really impressive things, and screwing it up would be to diminish the usefulness of 3D printers and 3D printing more generally.
If I decide to make a 3D printer copy of a Frisbee or a medical device or an auto part, whatever, and those are patented products, what about the harm to the patent owner? How do you construct fair use when you're talking about physical goods?
Well, one of the things about physical goods that is a huge difference from music and movies and articles and photos, not all physical goods are necessarily even protected by copyright. But when you do have something that is protected by copyright, the same fair use rules apply. It's a different context, but it's the same kind of analysis.
There have been various stabs at trying to find a solution, trying to accommodate innovation and also to protect intellectual property rights, digital rights management, willy-nilly lawsuits meant to intimidate infringers, and so on. But in the end, at least in the music business, the content creators ended up having to change their business model. In manufacturing, you make stuff and you sell it.
How can anyone adapt to this new reality?
Maybe instead of having to manufacture that good and put it in a warehouse and ship it and distribute it, you give people a way to buy those goods online and download the files and make them yourself. Now, it's certainly a different model, but in some ways, it's a superior model because a lot of those costs are costs you don't have to worry about anymore. It's not necessarily an easy change, but it's not impossible to imagine.
Now, this conversation is premised on the assumption that Congress and regulators, their first instinct will be to overreact. What do you tell them by way of getting them to embrace the kinds of innovation that you're dreaming about?
Talk about all the advantages that 3D printing brings. And so when that policymaker is faced with a choice to regulate 3D printing or to pass laws related to 3D printing, there's not just an assumption that this is a problem that we need to get under control, but that getting something like 3D printing, quote unquote, under control actually diminishes its usefulness and has a lot of costs.
All right. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael Weinberg is a vice president at Public Knowledge, a nonprofit dedicated to preserving the openness of the internet.
Kenneth Goldsmith was selected as the Museum of Modern Art's first poet laureate this spring. He's also a plagiarist. Most of his poetry is derived from transcriptions, copies, and collages of existing works. For instance, he retyped an entire edition of the New York Times to create his book, Day. He's also the author of a book about his views and process called Uncreative Writing. That's become the genesis for classes he's taught at Princeton and the University of Pennsylvania. He demands that his students surrender any attempt at creativity and assigns them texts to copy and sometimes defend.
The choices that we make are as expressive of ourselves as any kind of personal narrative we might do about our family or growing up. We've just never been taught to value those choices.
Now, each semester, the students are told to purchase a term paper from an online paper mill and sign their name to it.
And then they have to get up and present it as if they wrote it convincingly.
What is the purpose of that assignment?
Well, I'm of the feeling that the idea of being a contemporary writer is making your way through this morass of information. There's so much information out there already that really one need not create any more.
Then why copy? Why transcribe? Why bother to do any of that?
The point is actually in pointing. You look at a blog like Boing Boing. They don't make anything. They point. Being pointed at by Boing Boing far outweighs the thing at which they're pointing. So making has become secondary to pointing.
You wrote that literature is in a rut, that it tends to hit the same note again and again, unable to take part in arguably the most vital and exciting cultural discourses of our time.
You know, if it's not dealing with distribution, if it's not dealing with replication, if it's not dealing with copyright, in a weird way, it's not being contemporary. These really are the issues of our time, and they're at stake everywhere you look. It's already a done deal in music and sampling. It's been a done deal for 100 years in visual art with the advent of Marcel Duchamp's ready-mades. Every other place in culture has sort of moved past these kind of stagnant ideas of originality.
So you want to create this kind of plagiaristic aesthetic for text. What's the big challenge?
I feel that one of the reasons that visual art has been able to take a different turn was because 150 years ago it met the camera. And the camera forced painting to go abstract, take on all these extra ideas other than simple representation. There was a machine that did it better. This happened in music with the sampler and with magnetic tape. And suddenly, it's happening now in literature with the internet.
There are intellectual property laws. How do you instruct your students to handle that issue?
A lot of this is economy-based. The economy of poetry is a pretty utopian, open economy because there is no economics around it. Everybody says poetry doesn't matter, but actually poetry really does matter because one can test extreme utopian aesthetic ideals without any repercussion whatsoever.
Because you're an artsy-fartsy poet who lives in an ethereal world. In a world where content has monetary value, these aesthetics cannot be applied without running into the law. So you send your students out there saying, go ahead, make your art, just make sure you won't make any money off of it.
Well, I think that's their generation's challenge. But what it does is it reimagines and re-envisions what being creative is. Another tool that they can use as they go out into the world as writers. And somebody said, you know what, it's actually okay to use that tool. Examples of James Joyce in Ulysses, patch writing the entire Ithaca chapter.
I'm not sure what patch writing is.
Patch writing is what students do all the time, taking several sources and stringing them together, adding a few connecting words to make it all seem unique. My students are so good at patch writing and plagiarism, but it's always done on the down low. The question is, in my classes, how can we make your technique a little bit better?
I mean, I would love to give listeners an example, but what they would just hear is something that, absent its framing, would have little content.
You're wrong there. The voice hydrates the driest of texts. At the White House, I did a little set about the Brooklyn Bridge, and I read a short excerpt from Whitman's Crossing Brooklyn Ferry, and then Hart Crane's modernist 1930s poem, The Bridge, and then I finished up with some traffic reports that included the bridge as a bit player from my book, Traffic. Now, of course, the president and the first lady were there, and they were Democratic Party donors and arts administrators and senators and the like, and they kind of quietly sat through the Whitman and they sat through the Crane, you know, the real poetry. But when it came to the traffic reports, the whole room jumped. It was language that they could recognize. It was, you know, their language. The most avant-garde move was the one that excited them the most. John Cage said, you know, music is all around us if only we had the ears to hear it. And I'll actually say the same thing. Poetry is all around us if we only had the eyes to see it and identify it.
Kenneth, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Kenneth Goldsmith is the Museum of Modern Art's Poet Laureate and the author of the forthcoming Seven American Deaths and Disasters. Let's hear some plagiarism.
1201, well, in conjunction with the big holiday weekend, we start out with the Hudson River horror show right now. Big delays in the Holland Tunnel either way with road work. Only one lane will be getting by. You're talking about at least 20 to 30 minutes worth of traffic either way. Meanwhile, the Lincoln Tunnel, not great back to Jersey, but still your best option. And the GW Bridge, 30 to 40 minute delays, and that's just going into town. Lower level closed, upper level all you get. Then back to New Jersey, every approach is fouled up. The West Side Highway from the 150s. The Major Deegan, the Bronx approaches, and the Harlem River Drive are all a disaster.
Because we were doing this hour on ownership, I looked up the word property in the thesaurus. I love the thesaurus because it breaks down the synonyms of a word into groups like hues on a big color wheel. Turns out that the synonyms for property essentially fall into two color families. Predictably, the first are words related to possession, as in ownership, title, claim, stake. The second are words that link property to the nature of a thing, as in aura, effect, flavor, feeling, or character, quality, virtue, or quirk. Now, here's the interesting thing. The online etymology dictionary says that the second meaning actually emerged first. 800 years ago or so, property's meaning was pretty much related to the essential nature of something, as in, it's the property of water to conform to the shape of the vessel it's in. The fact is, property didn't come to mean possession until the 17th century. But the link between the two meanings is clear. Something that's special, something that is one's own, is something we possess. Now our world runs on property. As the founders understood, it's a powerful engine of creativity that benefits us all. But like water, the essential nature of property must ultimately conform to the vessel it's in. Once we dwelled in a brick-and-mortar world. Now, as poet Kenneth Goldsmith observed, we swim in a digital ocean. The only certainty is that in such a fluid situation, 20 years hence, property will not mean what it means today. That's it for the show, which originally aired last spring.
On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alec Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Alexandra Hall, Ravenna Koenig, and Krista Ripple. And the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rick Kwan.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news and our boss. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts and read our fabulous blog at onthemedia.org. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And I really advise you to. There's very cool stuff there. And, of course, you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.